Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, the Pope and the People. We have a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday General Audience, where he described the current migration crisis as the world's greatest tragedy since World War II. More humour needed. We shine the spotlight on the figure of St. Thomas More, whose prayer asking God for a sense of good humour is prayed by the Pope every day. Let it be. As the Church marks the Annunciation of the Lord, a priest from Liverpool tells us more about the reported story behind the famous song by the Beatles with that title. The 50th anniversary of Popolorum Progressio. We revisit Blessed Pope Paul VI's groundbreaking social encyclical. And how blind are we? We have a Lenten reflection about the gospel story of the blind man cured and how no one got it. We begin our broadcast with a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday General Audience, where he spoke of how the ongoing migration crisis is the world's greatest tragedy since the Second World War. His comment came when greeting an Italian church organisation assisting migrants, where he urged the international community to continue to welcome migrants and promote their integration. Linda Bordoni reports.
In his appeal launched after the catechesis, Pope Francis reminded all Catholic communities to participate in the upcoming 24 Hours for the Lord initiative on the 23rd and 24th of March, an initiative that sees churches across the globe offering the sacrament of confession as a privileged moment of grace during our Lenten journey. And speaking to an Italian association that provides short and long-term services and help to migrants and refugees, the Pope highlighted the rights and the responsibilities of those who receive and of those who are received. And he described the current migration crisis as the greatest tragedy after World War II.
È la tragedia più grande dopo quella della Seconda Guerra Mondiale.
His words come just days before EU heads of state or government convene in the city to mark the 60th anniversary of the Treaties of Rome. In his catechesis, meanwhile, Pope Francis reflected on a reading from St. Paul, which focuses on the attitudes of steadfastness and encouragement. They are intimately connected to the reality of Christian hope, because ours, he said, is a God of steadfastness, as he loves us perseveringly and never tires of consoling us. He is also a God of encouragement, he continued, who calls us to be close to the weak and to the needy, with whom he asks us to be strong and to be sowers of hope. What's more, the Pope continued, Christians are called to spread hope by supporting and encouraging one another, especially those in danger of faltering. But we do so, he concluded, with the strength provided by the Lord, who is our unfailing source of hope. I'm Linda Bordoni.
A healthy Christian is a joyful Christian. And a Christian is full of joy and radiates joy. These are just two of the numerous quotes from Pope Francis, where he stresses the need for Christians to be cheerful and try to maintain a good sense of humour. So how does the Pope himself manage to follow that advice? One reason is because of a certain prayer he has spoken about on more than one occasion and that he prays every day. It's the prayer for good humour, and it was penned by the 16th century English martyr, St. Thomas More. Let's listen to this prayer.
Grant me, O Lord, good digestion, and also something to digest. Grant me a healthy body and the necessary good humour to maintain it. Grant me a simple soul that knows to treasure all that is good and that doesn't frighten easily at the sight of evil, but rather finds the means to put things back in their place. Give me a soul that knows not boredom, grumblings, sighs, and laments, nor excess of stress, because of that obstructing thing called I. Grant me, O Lord, a sense of good humour. Allow me the grace to be able to take a joke, to discover in life a bit of joy, and to be able to share it with others.
But how is it that Thomas More had such a keen sense of humour, when a look at his biography would suggest that his life and untimely death was hardly a laughing matter? More was a chancellor to the English King Henry VIII and was tried for treason and beheaded after he refused to acknowledge the monarch as head of the Church of England following his break with Rome. And even in the last moments before his death, More's renowned sense of humour did not desert him. While he was mounting the scaffold for his execution, More asked the official to help him up the steps, saying, "Coming down, I will look after myself." A profoundly religious man, More revealed in his writings that he believed a sense of humour had an important part to play in his spiritual life. Thomas More was canonised by the Catholic Church in 1935, along with his fellow English martyr, Cardinal John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester. The Cardinal, too, was beheaded in that same period for refusing to acknowledge the King's supremacy over the Church in England. Veronica Scaresbrook found out more details about that canonisation process for the two English saints by looking at the copy of a Vatican document in Latin, written in 1930, that refers to the ongoing sainthood cause. Let's listen to her conversation with Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's former Latinist, to find out more.
You know what I found? I found something that maybe you're interested in.
Ah.
The canonization of...
the Blessed Martyrs, Cardinal John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, and Thomas More, the Chancellor of England.
Okay, in Latin, I'm reading here. Canonizationis Beatorum Martyrum...
Cardinalis...
Johannes Fisher.
Episcopi Rofensis.
How Rofensis becomes Rochester, I don't know. And Thomas More, Tomae More.
Cancellarii Angliae.
Why does it start with super dubio? Super doubt?
Yeah, when they're asking a question.
So
and
a
because,
doubt.
Because the doubt is in the next line with these letters here. Whether... a commission should be assigned, resuming the case, undertake once again, the case of canonization of these people. And then he goes on, of course, he has to say, you know, yes.
So, inter beatos martyris Angliae, qua glorioso, quae gloriosi titulo sanctorum insula, appellabatur.
Okay, among the blessed martyrs of England, which used to be called the Island of the Saints. Two illustrious men shine forth like stars.
At any rate, if you go down the page, it strikes me how they have a little bit of a biography of Thomas More.
Oh, certainly.
Who was born in London, Londini Natus,
anno 1480.
1480.
And educated in Oxford.
Oxoni.
Pius, Oxonii Educatus. Educated in Oxford.
Why are there two I's on Oxonii?
Because it's what they call the locative. Oxonii in Oxford. Pious from his childhood, and so on and so on. Praebat fidelibus super abbot Chelsea. He was taking the lead in front of all the faithful of his parish in Chelsea.
A man for all seasons.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
How do you say a man for all seasons?
Omnibus temporibus. Viractus. Oh, I can say it better than that. You saw the movie and so on.
Yes.
And his daughters and Henry comes up there.
They speak about Henry VIII. If you
and
turn
the daughters go out into the water and say, "Oh, salve me Rex," and they address Henry VIII in Latin when he came up on his barge up to Chelsea.
How'd you say Henry VIII came up on his barge up?
Up
the Thames rather than to Chelsea.
Chelsea am venit vicula sua Henricus Rex.
In fact, in this text, if you turn that page and you go to the first paragraph here, They speak about Henry VIII. Paulo post rex Enricus
Octavus.
Octavus is in the Latin numerals, whereas I noticed that the birth of Thomas More, despite being in Latin, was not in Roman numerals.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. That's just the thing.
1480. Anyway, my Latin is, as you know, very limited, but I can see that his wife, Caterina, was Irritas et Sacrilegia.
No, be careful. No. Henry VIII, who, while his legitimate wife, Catherine, was still living, Tentaverat had tried invalid and sacrilegious marriage with Anna Bolena. You see the whole story there. When he had not been able to obtain the approval of his crime, nor of a divorce, nor of new matrimony, so on and so on, de facit, this is in line 5, he fell away from the Catholic religion and from obedience toward the Roman pontiff.
A religione cattolica et ab obedientia
erga Romanum pontificem defecit.
Et rebellionis vexillum
erexit. And he set up a flag of rebellion.
A flag.
Well, vexillum, a standard. Oh, it's glorious.
Sub quo subditos subditos.
Subditos suos cum nefando et credeli sue religion potus abusu militare coegit. Under which flag he forced subditos suos, his subjects, to fight with a unspeakable nefando, an unspeakable and cruel abuse of his royal power.
There's lots here in italics.
And that's why he says this doubt here at the end here.
Where?
Whether the commission should be revised. And he says, affirmative. A commission should be designated of the resumption of the case if it will have pleased His Holiness.
Well, why is that interesting?
I mean, so that was the end of the doubt. Should we reopen the case of canonization for these two guys? And of course, he says, yes, His Holiness considered this a good thing, and so forth and so on.
Who was Pope Pius
the 11th in 1930.
And thanks there to Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who worked for many years as the Pope's Latinist. He was speaking to Veronica Scaresbrick. As the Church marks the Annunciation of the Lord, where the angel Gabriel revealed to the Blessed Virgin Mary that she will become the Mother of Jesus, we remember the words spoken by Mary on that momentous occasion. Father Peter Fleetwood is a priest from the city of Liverpool, and he tells us more about a story behind the origins of that famous song by the Beatles entitled Let It Be.
When I was 11, halfway through the 1960s, I started secondary school. It was run by Jesuit priests in a very peaceful, leafy suburb of Liverpool. Our city was often in the news because of political trouble and industrial unrest, or because of one of the football teams that played there, but mainly because of music. If I went out of the main gate of the school at the end of the day, within 30 seconds I would be walking past the gates of Strawberry Fields, a special school for children with some kind of disability. A few minutes later, I would change buses at Penny Lane, a local bus terminus. Those of you who know the music of those days will recognise that the two places I mentioned are titles of songs written by the Beatles, Liverpool's most famous export in the 20th century. The Beatles knew that part of town because their school was about half a mile from ours. I hasten to add that they were several years older than we were. There's a story, I have no idea how true it is, but it seems to be quite accurate, that Paul McCartney, one of the Beatles, came home one afternoon to find his mother crying desperately, clutching a set of rosary beads and praying. She had just been told she had an incurable disease, cancer, I think, and had turned to a traditional Catholic prayer. The scene inspired Paul to write one of his most popular songs, which begins like this. When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom.
You probably know the song well.
I wonder how many of you knew how Paul came to write it. I was once asked by a priest whether Let It Be was an insult to Our Lady. When I told him this story, he was quite surprised, and I think he saw a much more positive side to the person who wrote the song.
Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be.
I find the image of a woman who has just found out she is never going to get better without a miracle very moving. I shall never forget the day it happened to my own mother. The great temptation is to give up. Why bother? I'm never going to get better, am I? But some people, amazingly, find the will to resist the inevitable. In the midst of her tears, Paul McCartney's mother prayed, apparently the first time he had seen her praying in years. After a terrible lurch into depression, my mother decided to go ahead with a pilgrimage to Lourdes, where she had never been, and to go full steam ahead and really enjoy whatever time she had left. Once she had decided that, she discovered a joy in life that had left her many years before. It was a bittersweet thing to see. She got a tremendous amount out of her pilgrimage, but it could never stop the cancer doing its work. Back to Paul McCartney's mother. The story made me think of many people I've met as they were dying. At that moment, many older Catholics fall back on the prayers they learned as children. I really worry about future generations of Catholics who know very few prayers and are not really used to God being a part of their daily lives. How will they feel when they have nobody else to turn to? Another thing, Mrs. McCartney and my mother all find Our Lady a great ally in times of trouble. Paul McCartney must have known Our Lady's life story well, because Let It Be is what she said when the angel told her God would be with her. Be it done unto me according to thy word.
Let it be, let it be.
Please never turn your nose up at the rosary. Paul didn't. It is a humble prayer, but extraordinarily powerful. Let it be, and Mary's prayer tell us that even in the most incomprehensible circumstances, it is worth bothering because God will be there.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be.
A big thank you there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, a parish priest from the Archdiocese of Liverpool in England. The Italian capital was in the international spotlight during this past weekend, with high-level celebrations marking the 60th anniversary since the signing of the Treaty of Rome. Signed on the 25th of March 1957, this landmark treaty established the European Economic Community, the forerunner of today's European Union. The Roman pontiff at the time of that treaty signing was Pius XII. Let's step back in time and, with the help of Veronica Scaresbrick, listen to the Pope's words to mark that historic event.
A scrapbook in sound from our very own Vatican Radio archives.
We welcome the opportunity to say a word of praise and encouragement for those who are most certainly in the forefront of the champions of Christ's cause in your country.
The voice of Pius XII, the man who was Roman pontiff at the time of the signing of the first Treaty of Rome. The recording is a rare one, picked from less than a handful of papal radio messages in English, broadcast through the microphones of our radio station the very same year of that historic signature, 1957, offering us a taste of that era.
Catholics have the noble and truly patriotic task and ambition to help that public opinion to find and hold to the path of truth and justice, and let us say it simply and honestly, holy living. If you succeed in this, we'll have made a momentous contribution to the peace, prosperity, and the power for good of your beloved country.
Like everyone else at the time, Pope Pius XII must have closely followed this historic event taking place on Rome's Capitoline Hill. And a couple of months later, he was to address a large group of European parliamentarians in private audience. As protocol dictated, the event was not recorded by our radio station, but the Pope's speech was safely archived. Clearly at the heart of this address was his concern regarding the new chapter in European history. It was the 13th of June, 1957, and in the Vatican's Sala Regia, thousands of politicians had gathered around Pius XII. Among them, the president of the Movement for European Unity of the time, today considered to be the father of Europe, his name Robert Schuman. Together with him, politicians from more than 16 European nations in Rome for a European Congress, taking place in the aftermath of the signing of the Treaty of Rome. All may have had European unity at heart, but not all were from the six signatory nations of the historical international agreements that had taken place on the 25th of March of that year. Namely France, the Federal Republic of Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and of course, the host country Italy. Speaking in French, the language of diplomacy, Pius XII highlighted the importance of Europe's Christian roots. Laying down the foundations of Europe, which has so often witnessed bloody conflicts, he said, may require patience, but is impelling for lasting cohesion in this historic mission. Human societies, the Pope stressed, are always in the making, and Christianity gives them that element of growth and stability necessary to guide the march towards a set goal and the certainty of a nation which is not of this world, one where union will be perfect because it comes from the force and light of God. Among your duties, Pius XII added finally, is the ratification of the Treaty of Rome and, eventually, the drawing up of a constitution for this unique political organism. Who knows, perhaps it was this particular audience or the signing of the Treaty of Rome to inspire Pius XII to compose a special prayer for Catholic parliamentarians and politicians only months later. Calling on God, Creator of heaven and earth, to inspire Catholic politicians to distinguish the just from the unjust as a reflection of divine wisdom.
Once inward vision, they must be lifted up from the dark, confusing complexities of a passing world, to keep steadily in view the sheer white light of eternity.
And thanks there to Veronica Scaresbrick, who produced that programme. Moving on to another key anniversary. It was 50 years ago when blessed Pope Paul VI published his social encyclical Populorum Progressio, or The Development of Peoples. In this document, released on March 26, 1967, the Pope wrote about the importance of integral human development and stressed the principle of solidarity. To find out more about this groundbreaking social encyclical, Veronica Scaresbrick spoke to a professor of Catholic social teaching at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome. He's Dominican Father Alejandro Crosswaite.
Vatican II has already taken place, which already opened the church. So the church is also a very different church from the one we had during John the 23rd. And so everything is in movement. Everything is in transition. Vatican II was very optimistic. Gaudium Spes, that basically calls the church to be servant in the world, to be attentive to the needs of the human person. And the principle that comes out of Gaudium Spes from 1965 is the whole question of human dignity. So that's why I think Paul VI names this encyclical Populorum Progressio, the progress of the peoples. So he's discovering that, and so he talks about progress, and he talks about development. As countries are developing and so on, he has a special concern with the principle of solidarity with people. And so that becomes a new term.
That was Father Alejandro Crosthwaite.
Blindness is the theme of our latest Lenten reflection by Father Colm Kelly, chaplain for the Apostleship of the Sea, the Church's maritime agency. Taking his cue from the gospel account of Jesus healing a blind man and how nobody around him got it, Father Kelly writes from the viewpoint of the seafarers he ministers to and whose jobs entail spending many weeks at sea.
This morning I read the gospel story of the cure of the blind man, and it got me thinking not only about physical loss of sight, but about the many different types of blindness around us. In the seafarer's world, I sometimes hear the phrase sea blindness. Not exactly sure what that's supposed to mean, but it makes me think that we, as a group, are taken for granted, or worse still, people don't even know that we exist. Goods arrive in the shops, but people often don't know how they got there, and certainly there's no understanding of the difficult lives that seafarers lead to make all the choices in our shops possible. Hey, but there I go again, complaining about my lot and finding others to blame for the things that make me anxious. And all this complaining can make me blind to the many blessings in my life. Do you get like that sometimes? Being obsessed with what is wrong and finding someone to pin the blame on, and in the process, blinding yourself to the many wonderful things that God has given you, not least his great love for you. With all this talk of blindness, let's think about our ability to see. How well can I see? My vision is perfect when it comes to seeing the many faults and failings of all those around me. But surely all this is very one-sided. What am I missing? Maybe we are blind to where the Lord wants to lead us, blind to the many ways that God wants to love us. We just don't get it. And in this gospel story about blindness, the man was cured, but people didn't seem to get it. His neighbours and those who had seen him earlier as a beggar said, "Isn't this the one who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is," but others said, "Well, it might just look like him." No one could even recognize him because his life had been changed. John tells many stories of blindness in his gospel. The disciples on the road to Emmaus who didn't recognize Jesus. Mary Magdalene in the garden after the resurrection. She thought that Jesus was the gardener. So perhaps I need to make a resolution in this voyage of Lent. I need to pray that my eyes will not be blinded by prejudice or by suspicion. Lent is a process of having our eyes opened to see and hope and love as Jesus does. The invitation of Jesus to the man born blind is clear, and it's the very same invitation to each one of us. Go, wash, see.
And thanks there to Father Colm Kelly of the Apostleship of the Sea for that Lenten reflection. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudator Jesus Christus.